There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.
Welcome to the Bite Size Business Breakfast. We are going to be looking at space. We're going to be looking at a big landmark legal case in Saudi Arabia. And we're also going to be looking at Wamda Capital, investment company in the region that is looking to help startups. But first, let's have a look at the business headlines.
Business headlines.
Etihad Airways says it will defend itself vigorously against a €2 billion lawsuit from the liquidator of Air Berlin. Etihad was a major shareholder of Air Berlin before the German airline collapsed last year.
Virgin Galactic, in which Abu Dhabi has a 30% stake, has completed its first successful space flight. The company now wants to take tourists to space, with tickets costing around $250,000.
Wyndham Hotels is going to manage three new properties. They're going to be on the Dera side of Dubai Creek.
Kuwait is to let foreign investors buy and trade shares in the country's banks. Non-Kuwaiti investors will be able to own up to 5% of a lender's capital.
Sharjah government says over the weekend that it's going to take a majority stake in Investbank. Size of the stake or its value have not been announced.
And the luxury goods company LVMH has bought the Orient Express as part of a $3 billion deal. The takeover of hospitality firm Belmond includes 44 luxury hotels, among them the Hotel Cipriani in Venice.
This is the Business Breakfast on Dubai Eye 103.8.
The authority on the issues that matter.
Over the weekend, Virgin Galactic managed to get its spacecraft to the very edge of space. In fact, edging into space at about 82 kilometres above the Earth's surface. George Whiteside, the CEO of Virgin Galactic, spoke to the Business Breakfast this morning.
Explain in simple terms why you think this flight was so significant.
We have been working to open up space to, you know, humanity for a long time and really are grateful for the support and investment of UAE. And so what we did on this flight was basically we made it to space with the commercial configuration of our vehicle for the first time. And this was actually the first time that a spaceship with people on board had launched from American soil into space since the retirement of the space shuttle. So it was actually a really big deal here in the United States, big deal internationally. And, you know, we're ready to start making history soon.
So you've reached 82 kilometers, which is good enough for the U.S. Air Force. They've given your guys their space astronaut wings. There are those who say, actually, no, space is 100 kilometers, the so-called Kármán line. You're a NASA veteran, so you're very familiar with these things. How significant are these distinctions?
You know, so NASA gives astronaut wings when you go about 50 miles, U.S. Air Force, FAA. Basically, all the U.S. Institutions give astronaut wings. And, you know, we're a U.S. company, so that works for us. You know, what's interesting is that FAI, which has put out that 100-kilometer thing, has actually said to the world that they're thinking of moving that back down to 80 kilometers. So I think there's growing consensus that the right level is about 80 kilometers, which equals about 50 miles.
So this was a successful test flight, and I saw Sir Richard Branson speaking over the weekend. Clearly, he is delighted, but we've spoken to him about the events of 2014 when, of course, you had a fatal crash. What's changed in those 4 years? What lessons have you learned?
Well, that was a really tough day, you know, but the main thing is that what we're trying to do in our test flight program is to make sure that when we're ready to start commercial service for our over 600 individuals who put down deposits already, when we're ready to do that, we do it with a safe vehicle. And, you know, progress is hard. We mourned the loss of that test pilot who worked for a contractor of ours. But we move forward, and I'm really proud of how the team has emerged from that. They built a new vehicle. The vehicle is improved. It has a few safety improvements to make sure that what happened could never happen again. And we feel really good about the vehicle now, and we're really excited about the momentum that we're taking into 2019.
So as you say, you're a U.S. company. The flight took off from the Mojave Desert in California. But with backing from the Middle East, Mubadala has had a stake in Virgin Galactic for almost a decade now. What does Mubadala and Abu Dhabi bring to the table for you guys, George?
Well, I think a few things. So number one, we're really grateful for the investment and the support. Mubadala is not just an investment company. It actually is a really smart center of aerospace knowledge. So the folks who are on our board bring tremendous value in terms of connections or ways of doing business better, ways of doing aerospace manufacturing better. So there's a huge amount of value added beyond just the original investment. The other thing I would say is that we're tremendously excited about our, you know, growing relationship with the UAE Space Agency, which has really attracted global attention. They're doing amazing things, obviously, with the Mars mission and other things. And so between that and Mubadala, Elaine, all the things that are happening out there, Strata Manufacturing. There's just a lot of excitement about the leadership position of the UAE in aerospace today.
And of course, those Middle East links inevitably get us asking questions, George. Well, are we going to have one taking off from the UAE? How many Middle East customers have bought tickets? What can you tell us about that?
Well, in terms of the number of Middle East customers, you know, we don't disclose exact numbers because it's sort of a privacy issue. But I can say that there's strong interest in the Middle East, as you might imagine. And, you know, in terms of future operations, all I can say is that, you know, Richard Branson is really excited about sharing the excitement and the wonder and the research potential and the commercial opportunities of human spaceflight with the rest of the world. And so, you know, I think the idea of someday potentially operating from the UAE is a very real one. And I think now that we are demonstrating the commercial capabilities of this vehicle, which is intrinsically mobile, I think that, those prospects will grow.
So, George, great weekend, of course, for you guys getting to space. What happens next? When can we expect the first tourists paying $250,000 to be taking a space flight? Any indications?
Well, so what we have to go here is we're going to do a few more envelope expansion test flights, and then we're going to be starting to put in the commercial cabin, which is basically all built. We just need to install it into the spaceship. Then we'll do a few testing flights of operations in the back to make sure that'll be with staff. So we'll make sure that our processes for our customers are safe and just super enjoyable and incredible, right? That moment when you get up into space and you can look out the window for the first time down at your home planet. I mean, I just get shivers thinking about that. I want to do it myself. And then at that point, you know, we're going to be ready to go start commercial operations. Now, I can't say exactly when that'll be, but I think that we're really pretty close now. We have to look at the data from this flight, and we'll have a few more test flights to go. But we're really getting pretty close now.
Well, here in the Business Breakfast studio, we're really keen to know when Sir Richard might be going up. Last time we spoke to him was earlier on this year on a very different kind of craft. It was the QE2 cruise liner, which is moored here in Dubai. When can we expect to see Sir Richard up in this aircraft? 2019, is that a realistic possibility?
Oh, absolutely. 2019 is the goal.
Last question. What's the biggest challenge that you still face at Virgin Galactic?
Well, you know, what we are doing is intrinsically hard, right? No one has done it before, establish a commercial spaceflight service, right? So our guiding star is safety. We feel really good coming out of this flight that we've got a vehicle that does what it says it's going to do in a really safe way. What we have to do now is to set up, you know, almost like an airline, you know, but it's a low-rate airline, but it's an airline nonetheless. And that's where, you know, the experience from Virgin Group is so useful because they've got airlines all over the world. They really are helpful. And frankly, you know, I'm sure we'll be getting a lot of great input from our UAE folks because they obviously are world experts at that as well.
So you think the greatest challenge is more technical and aeronautical rather than, say, commercial with the likes of Elon Musk also launching space ventures or space tourism ventures?
Yeah, well, I mean, I would really say we're competing with ourselves in a way. We really just have to do this right. What Elon's doing is amazing, but it's a very different thing. You know, he's launching these huge satellites into space and going to the moon. What we're doing is trying to bring that cost down for just that flight into space, you know, that simple flight into space. Right now, the cheapest seat that you can buy into space is with the Russians, and it's $70 million. Our tickets are, you know, in the few hundred thousand dollars range. So we're bringing that cost down by a factor of 300, which is that's what's going to open up space and really enable thousands and eventually millions of people to travel into space.
Best of luck with that, George. Really appreciate you joining us this evening as it is with you in the United States. George Whitesides, Chief Executive of Virgin Galactic. Collect congratulations and thanks.
This is the Business Breakfast on Dubai Eye 103.8.
The authority on the issues that matter.
One case the Business Breakfast has been following for a number of years is that between Ahmed Hamad Al-Ghusaybin brothers, known as Ahab, and Man Al-Sanaya. And it's just rumbled on and on. It's caused Al-Ghusaybin all sorts of issues. Simon Charlton is the chief restructuring officer there, and he talks about the latest in the court case.
Before we chat about what's happening in what is now the case that's going through court, do you want to just remind us of the situation, how we got here?
We 10 years in May, the group went into a situation with about $9 billion in debt. The Saad Group also went into default, another probably $10 billion or more in debt. So we have a $20 billion situation, 10 years old. And for the last 10 years, I think us, the banks and the Saad Group have been trying to come to a resolution. We filed for bankruptcy protection and a settlement on the 2nd of December, first time that's been done in Saudi Arabia. And we had our first court hearing before the commercial court in Dammam last Wednesday.
And this, as you say, is the first filing under these new bankruptcy laws. What have you actually applied for? What kind of protection have you applied for?
So there are various different regimes you can apply for. You can apply for a liquidation, you can apply for restructuring, or you can apply to have a settlement approved. And we've spent probably the best part of the last 4 years negotiating a settlement with about 100 banks all over the world. We were before the enforcement court, and it became clear that they weren't going to endorse the settlement without unanimous support. And thankfully, the government in Saudi Arabia introduced a bankruptcy law this year, under which if you can have a majority support, you can have what they call a cram down and force that on dissenting creditors. So we applied for that on the 2nd of December.
Is there a suggestion in that ruling that the banks could have to give you money back, that they were aware of where Manal Sunia's money came from?
One of the advantages of the bankruptcy law, which was something that definitely appealed to us, is it focuses on equality and fair treatment of creditors. And I think that's going to be one of the defining features and one of the big tests for Saudi Arabia. There's been a concern, particularly on the part of international lenders, that perhaps the Saudi banks would be preferred. And to date, the government hasn't given any indication of that. And we hope that under this law, the fair treatment will mean that banks who have preferred themselves, who have taken assets previously, will be forced to return those and that those assets will be shared equally. So it's not really directed towards the Al Sunea group, but more towards some of the Saudi banks that we say have preferred themselves, and we think those assets should be given back and shared with everybody.
So what happened on Wednesday?
It was an interesting day. We showed up in court. It looked just like every other court I've ever been in Saudi Arabia, which didn't fill me with a huge amount of optimism. But luckily, the judge was very well read. He was quite young, but he knew the law. He knew what we were doing there. He seemed very on top of it. So I was impressed by that. I was also impressed by the enthusiasm with which he wanted to move this forward. And he said he wanted this done within 6 months. And he set the first hearing for the 31st of December, which, of course, is New Year's Eve. So we managed to get an extra 7 days, and we're now on the 7th of January, by which time we have to have notified all of our creditors anywhere in the world, which will be quite a task. We also have to appoint an administrator, a trustee in bankruptcy, to review our petition. And then we go back on the 7th of January. And if we pass that test, then within 40 days of that, we have to have a vote of creditors, after which, if the settlement is approved, we can start making distributions to creditors.
And you've been in London over the weekend speaking to creditors. How did that go?
Yep. I was in Saudi on Wednesday. I flew up to London on Thursday. A lot of our debt's been purchased by the distressed desks and the hedge funds in London, so I felt it was important to see them. I would say there was a concern about starting a new process in Saudi, but I think generally everybody's pretty excited and optimistic, particularly given the events of last Wednesday. And, you know, I'm hoping we will get their support and the support of the banks in the region to move this forward.
So what are the next steps? You've got that court date for the 7th of January. What do you do now?
Yep. Notify our creditors, and that has to be done through a formal process, but also through a more informal outreach. And that's, you know, given the holiday period, contacting 100 different banks around the world, that'll be no small feat. We also have to appoint a trustee to review our petition and really just get out there, put the word out and get people interested in what we're doing and signed up to the settlement.
What's happening to that debt at the moment, Simon? You say it's very actively traded on the secondary market, which is quite a hard concept to get one's head around. In simple terms, like how many cents in the dollar is it trading at the moment? What kind of ballpark figures can you give us?
You know, right now, I think the Ahab debt is probably at around 13 to 15 cents in the dollar. We had got as high as 18 to 20. I think it's important to remember most banks have written that down to zero. The secondary markets become quite important in the Middle East. And, you know, the active trading of that debt does give people the opportunity to get out if they don't want to stay in. So it's become quite a, I'd say about a third of our debt now is probably held by the secondary market. So it's become quite an important part of what we're doing. And they're also very proactive in trying to get to an exit.
Does this latest process bring you any closer to perhaps retrieving more money from Marnell Sonea?
Well, we sure hope so. You know, we hold him primarily responsible. We have a judgment against him for $2.5 billion, which is currently going through the enforcement process, which again will be a first for Saudi Arabia. It'll be the first time that a Cayman Islands judgment will be recognised in Saudi, and then that judgment will then form part of the process in the liquidation of the Saad Group. So we're hoping that that will be a major source of recovery for our creditors.
I mean, in terms of recovery, I mean, this relationship, if you're sort of effectively going to get money back from the Saudi banks, what's the relationship between Ahab and those Saudi banks going to be going forward when the company needs them for loans or whatever else in the future?
I mean, I think to be very clear, it's not all of the Saudi banks, and some of the Saudi banks we do have a reasonably good relationship with. And I'm hoping that going forward, once we emerge from this, that the group will have access to credit so that it can continue to grow its businesses.
Before we let you go, Simon, what are the international implications here for other organisations who might be watching what happens with this case?
You know, I think it's become quite an important focus point. If you're looking to invest in Saudi Arabia, and we all know that the vision of the Crown Prince and the government is to attract inward investment, and I think having an exit when things go wrong and showing the world that there will be a fair treatment of creditors is a very important test for Saudi Arabia. So I think people are watching this pretty closely.
Simon Charlton, Chief Restructuring Officer and Acting Chief Executive of Ahmed Al-Ghusaibi and Brothers. Thank you very much for your time this morning.
Thank you.
This is The Business Breakfast on Dubai Eye 103.8.
The authority on the issues that matter.
Pleased to be able to talk to Faris Gundoor, the partner at Wamda Capital, looking at changing investment opportunities and also how they're helping small companies in the UAE. How do you describe yourselves? How do you look at yourselves?
We are a platform that has various different offerings that support entrepreneurs and technology businesses in the MENA region and beyond. That includes mentorship programs. It includes media offering, Wamda.com, very similar to TechCrunch.com. And, you know, arguably most importantly, but definitely most effective, is our investment arm, which is Wamda Capital. We try and position ourselves as venture investors insofar as the positive aspect of that, but also we also try and position ourselves as multi-stage investors. So we've recently announced the launch of Wamda X on Thursday, which is a early stage grant program for budding entrepreneurs that allows us to capture a much wider range of startups and founders in the region. So
we'll talk about Wamda X in a few minutes. How do you actually get your money to invest?
Right. So we're a standard kind of GP LP structure, which means we go out to either wealthy individuals, strategic investors, institutional money, and get them to, you know, convince them that we're the right people to back, so that they're able to create, you know, generate some upside by way of technology exposure.
Is that an easy thing
in
today's world?
It's very difficult. I think it's it's a very long cycle. It takes us, you know, our first fund took us about a couple of years to close from the moment we started soliciting. There's a lot of capital flight out of the region, you know, because of the situation in Saudi and situation in the wider market. So a lot of people want to diversify away from the region, but we are still very bullish on the fundamentals and the underlying of what we invest in, which is tech.
But bullish over perhaps a longer term than you might have been before. What sort of
our investment period's 5 years, our holding period or harvesting period's an additional 5 years. So that's a 10-year horizon we look at.
Have you seen the amount that the investors you're talking to are actually giving you? Has that dropped a bit?
The amount that they've given us hasn't necessarily dropped, but it continues to be equally as difficult, I would say, to fundraise in today's market as it was for our first fund. We expected the second fund to be a little bit easier to fundraise just because of track record. But despite that, we've got the interest and we're ready to close in on our second fund. But it took us a long time to get to this point, to be honest.
Well, you've invested in local UAE companies such as Kareem, Arabia Weather, Luxury Closet, Yellow Compare, Mum's World, etc.
Sure.
What has the money gone to? What sort of transformational successes can you point to in their businesses?
Right. Most of the businesses we invest in and at the stage we invest in, these are, you know, obviously loss-making businesses. The objective is primarily growth and capturing market share, but not necessarily at the expense of economics and good unit economics. So we don't look, you know, we look for to invest in capital efficient businesses within the tech space. That often includes consumer technology. You know, over 40% of our portfolio is e-commerce because that's just such a massive opportunity in the region. But we also look for businesses that are solving major market failures or major issues that have been, you know, overlooked by incumbents or just have been neglected in the past. So that may include
some
financial
disruptors
inclusion.
And people like that, sort of fintech, etc.
Yeah, that's right.
If I was a year old company, what sort of level of money could I approach you for? What's your sort of typical give out?
So I think, you know, the MENA region doesn't have the pleasure of being as mature in terms of its venture cycle as, let's say, some of the more, you know, developed markets or some of the Eastern markets like China. We can't afford to be very specific about the stage we want to invest in. But that's also a good thing because it allows us to capture any kind of business, regardless of stage, up to, let's say, a Series A, which is a typical $5 million check. But I'd say about a year, and you should expect to have some form of product market fit, which effectively means you've gone out to the market, you've generated revenues of $100,000 to $500,000 annualized.
I know you'll take a stake in these companies, and I suppose that stake would be realized when those companies go to market and have an IPO. But I mean, I'm trying to think on the Business Breakfast, last time we talked about a successful IPO in this region. I mean, how hard is it to make your money back?
We actually don't look to IPOs at all, especially not in the region. First of all, you know, going public in the region is very difficult. We lack the liquidity that some of the Western markets do. But inherently, companies that go public here trade at a discount to their Western peers where, you know, these markets are more mature and more liquid. So if there were to be a situation where a company of ours would go public, it would probably be either on LSE or NASDAQ. And that's where tech generally goes public. We look towards strategic acquisitions or, you know, financial acquisitions from later stage investors like PE houses or maybe a strategic acquisition by a bigger competitor or something like that. That's where we generate our liquidity. And that typically takes 7 to 10 years.
Faris, talk to me about WonderX, the entrepreneurship program that you've launched.
Right. So our investment stage prior to launching WomdaX was seed and series A, which means checks of anywhere between 250,000 to a million for seed and 2 to 5 million for series A. And that what we realized over the years and through our previous fund as well, and we've done over 80 investments, was that what really drives a business is the founder and the founding team, effectively, who, you know, the best businesses in today's world are founder-led businesses. And so we identified a few traits in the most successful businesses founders, and we realized that you're able to discover those traits or identify those traits in an even earlier stage than, you know, capturing them at the seed or A stage. So we said, we want to build a program that effectively helps co-founders build their businesses, and we want to act as a co-founder ourselves. And so we went out and said, we want to encourage people to effectively quit their jobs and start businesses if they have the traits that, you know, are necessary to make for a successful business. And the way the program works is you apply. If you make it through, you are eligible for, well, you're not eligible. If you make it through, you actually get the $16,000 USD grant. And then it's a four-month program based in Dubai that we take you through. And then once you found your business, if we like that business, we continue to finance it all the way through the Series A stage. So we eliminate the headache of fundraising for budding entrepreneurs.
I mean, $60,000, would you give up your job? I don't know. I mean, it's
16, a, one six. Si-
yeah, $16,000. I mean,
right.
I mean, you got to be pretty brave to give up your job in this market.
Well, you've got to be very brave to start a business in any kind of market. So think of this not in context of, you know, what are you offering me in the sense of just financials, because the program does offer a very robust kind of access to network and access to mentorship for the people going through it, which is, and through the many years of surveying, has been identified as the most critical component of a business, is the network. But yes, the entrepreneurs do need to commit, and this is our way of helping them start a business. It's not our way of replacing the commitment they would have to make themselves.
And you've got your first tranche, your first running of this entrepreneurship fellowship next quarter. Have you selected the people who will take part?
We just launched on Thursday, which means applications have opened then. It's very much a referral-based program as well, which means if you are within the WAMDA network, we encourage you to go out and refer people that you know who are in the process of starting a business. So I'd say the chances of getting through the application process entail, or you know, are significantly improved if you know someone within the network who can vouch for you.
Thank you so much for joining us and talking candidly about your business. Faris Gundur, partner at WAMDA Capital, thank you very much.
I appreciate it. Thanks.
This is The Business Breakfast on Dubai Eye 103.8.
The authority on the issues that matter.
Thanks for listening to the Bite Size Business Breakfast podcast. We're back every morning at 6 a.m. Enjoy your day.
There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.